From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week, the Obama administration announced it would not release photos of prisoner abuse in Iraq and Afghanistan. An ACLU lawsuit settled at the end of last month compelled the Department of Defense to release the photos, and the White House said at the time it would comply. This week, the administration changed its tune. Press Secretary Robert Gibbs outlined President Obama's position on Wednesday.
He believes that the release of these photos could pose a threat to the men and women we have in harm's way in Iraq and Afghanistan, and doesn't believe that the government made the strongest case possible to the court and asked the legal team to go make that case.
The photos could have served as a visual aid in all the ongoing debates about torture that had played out during the week. Republicans pointed their fingers at Nancy Pelosi, saying she signed off on waterboarding. Democrats in the Senate led hearings on interrogation techniques under the Bush administration. And an op-ed by Richard Cohen in the Washington Post on Thursday, along with multiple TV appearances by former Vice President Dick Cheney, reignited a debate on cable news and blogs about whether torture works. But all those debates were waged without the photos. New Yorker staff writer Jane Mayer is author of the book The Dark Side, the inside story of how the war on terror turned into a war on American ideals. She says, like the rest of us, she's not exactly sure what's in the photos.
There's been a long, persistent rumor that there were pictures of kids being abused and women maybe being sexually abused, and I have not seen whether or not that is true. Without being able to see them, you really can't tell.
Seems to me there's two ways to view the question of to release or not to release. One is the truth and reconciliation path, you know, that we need to come to grips with our deeds, come what may. And the other is the sort of Danish cartoons problem, that the exercise in self-criticism just doesn't justify the risk of inflaming the world and endangering our troops.
Another possibility exists too, though, that if you don't actually release the documents, it leaves open to the human imagination what the United States was doing. And sometimes the imagination is even worse than the reality. I mean, if in fact these pictures are less bad than those at Abu Ghraib, then maybe they can put to rest rumors. The other point I wanted to make, though, was that if in fact those photographs show crimes of some sort, then this is evidence that needs to be turned over in some way to law enforcement authorities rather than just being deep-sixed someplace.
I want to play you two pieces of tape. The first is Presidential Press Secretary Robert Gibbs. The second, former Vice President Dick Cheney.
The president believes that the existence of the photos themselves doesn't actually add to the understanding that detainee abuse happened.
They campaigned all across the country against enhanced interrogation techniques and made it very clear they were opposed to that. They called it torture. I don't believe it was torture. We had attorneys who gave us clear guidance as to what was appropriate and what wasn't.
Now, I dare say if these photos were released, and assuming what they depict is at least as egregious as what we saw from Abu Ghraib, Cheney would be hard-pressed, even on the Fox News channel, to continue asserting that the so-called enhanced interrogation techniques aren't torture. Is that not alone justification for releasing them, to put that issue to rest once and for all?
Well, I mean, the Obama administration has been very clear in their own right in saying, for instance, that waterboarding was torture. So they are trying to hold the line saying that this is torture, but it's unnecessary to take another look at the details. I think the problem, though, is that so long as Vice President Cheney and others are still defending those policies, there's a debate out there. And without the public really being able to see what people are talking about, it's hard for the public to make up its mind.
Well, on the subject of debates, the debate seems to have shifted in the past few weeks into a question not of what constitutes torture, but assuming that enhanced interrogation techniques are torture, whether it has worked. Do you think that the release of these photos could shift the dialogue away from efficacy back to basic law and morality?
Well, I think there's a power in photographs that I'm sorry to say, as a writer, that is very hard to capture just in writing. And I think they have an immediacy and a kind of an emotional wallop that is very hard to deliver just by describing these techniques. Certainly those pictures that were released, the Abu Ghraib pictures, turned the entire debate on torture. It opened it up and it began the process of reform that we've seen since.
So the government has decided not to release them. It's not over. Do the courts still have a say in this? And is it not inevitable that at one point or another we will see these images?
I think it is inevitable we'll see these images, and the courts do have a say in it, because a judge has told the ACLU, which is sued to get these images, that they have a right to them. So I don't think we've seen the end of it yet. These are also, I have to say, not the only controversial photographs that exist. The CIA has apparently thousands of photographs of detainees, many of them in extremis and many of them naked. So this is just part of the photo collection that's now in the U.S. archive.
All right, Jane. Well, thank you so much.
Glad to be with you.
Jane Mayer is author of the book The Dark Side, the inside story of how the war on terror turned into a war on American ideals, which is released in paperback last week. Last December, we spoke with Republican consultant Frank Luntz, the man responsible for, among other verbal acrobatics, renaming the estate tax the death tax and recasting global warming as climate change. He made the following prediction on our show about then-president-elect Obama.
I think that he will engage in a rebranding and a rephraseology of the political lexicon.
This week, the Los Angeles Times reported on the Obama administration's rephrasing of the political lexicon. Jim Tankersley is a Washington Bureau reporter on the energy and environment beat for the Tribune Papers. He's written about the recent rebranding efforts, and he joins me now. Jim, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
During Obama's campaign, his website was peppered with the term cap and trade, referring to the limits on greenhouse gas emissions for business. You've written that cap and trade is now on the outs with the Obama administration. What in the world is wrong with it?
Well, most people don't understand it. Recent Rasmussen poll, in fact, this week, showed that 3/4 of the country doesn't really know that cap and trade is even associated with global warming. Every time I write about it, I have to spend a paragraph or two explaining exactly what it is, and there are still readers and even editors sometimes who are confused by it. So as a quick shorthand for we want to fight global warming, it's just not as an effective tool, I think, as the Obama administration wants.
Okay. What replaces it?
Well, what replaces it isn't necessarily a clear description of what they want to do on global warming. Cap and trade is a pretty good description of what they want to do on global warming. They want to cap greenhouse gas emissions with a system that allows big polluters or emitters to trade permits for those emissions. What they're trying to replace it with is something that's not really focused on global warming at all. It's this idea of clean energy jobs.
Okay, well, fair enough. Clean energy jobs might flow from the economy that is created by cap and trade legislation, but they're clearly not the same thing. Isn't that kind of squirrely?
Well, the other part of it is when you bring up cap and trade, you're necessarily talking about a policy mechanism, which, you know, it's just not that catchy. But if you talk about job creation, well, everybody knows that, and it can mean very different things to different people, which is sort of what they're going for here. They are allowing people to sort of look into their policy on global warming and, by framing it as clean energy jobs, see what they want there. You work in manufacturing, that means that you're going to be making wind turbines even if your auto factory closes. You are a scientist, well, that probably means more research dollars for you. You're in a depressed community, well, maybe solar cells could kickstart your rebirth. So it's sort of a green Rorschach, if you will, the administration's tossing out there for people to see.
Now, what about the phrase global warming itself? Obama's Council on Environmental Quality met with a research and marketing group to discuss alternatives to the phrase global warming. And the president has advised members of the House Energy and Commerce Committee to steer clear of it.
Well, global warming can be really polarizing. I know that every time I write about global warming, I get lots of email from readers who say, why are you spending so much time writing about what's essentially a hoax? There are certainly a lot of people out there who don't believe the science, and there's a very sharp partisan division over what to do, even among the people who do believe the science. So rather than kind of frame the issue again in terms of what has become somewhat of an emotional wedge, they're trying to steer the discussion back to this job creation, which, of course, everyone is supposed to be for.
Now, am I to understand that while the president wants to talk about green jobs, he is otherwise discarding the word green, as in green energy?
This is a big issue, particularly in the industrial heartland. Green to them, polls are showing, brings sort of these visions of an effete Al Gore, coastal, liberal, granola-eating kind of policy, whereas clean is something that everyone can relate to. It's something people equate with pollution. Clean air, clean water, clean energy. While they may be very different things, those three things, that's the framing that Democrats believe sells best in the Rust Belt.
The Democrats have certainly learned at the feet of their former masters. The Republicans, led by the consultant Frank Luntz, were geniuses at shaping the environmental debate. How are they, for example, dealing with cap and trade?
That's an interesting evolution, too. For a while, they were saying cap and tax, sort of a funny little play on cap and trade that emphasizes what's for sure the biggest downside of this policy, which is the very high likelihood that it will raise energy prices for consumers across the board. But then they ran into the same problem the Democrats did. Nobody really gets the cap and part. So they dropped the cap and tax, and now you hear them talking about a light switch tax or a national energy tax, which is sort of the preferred House Republican lexicon. They believe that this is a very effective club to swing at vulnerable Democrats.
In making your decisions about what language to use, do you shy away from clear language that might be associated with one side of the debate or the other for fear of being seen as, you know, under their thrall?
Well, it's much easier just to say clean energy jobs than it is to each time you do it try to explain it all the way through. But you kind of have to. Part of our job here is to educate people on a topic and to try to do it in a very apolitical way. And it may be that we run out of terms that can do that. You know, you look at the immigration debate. If you put illegal immigrant into the paper, you get a lot of angry mail from one side. If you put undocumented worker in, you get a lot of angry mail from the other. On the other hand, a big cap and trade bill, that's about dealing with global warming. And just because the White House doesn't want to talk about it necessarily as much doesn't mean we shouldn't.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Jim Tankersley is an energy and environment reporter in the Washington Bureau of the Los Angeles Times and the Chicago Tribune.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Hey, pod people. This is Katya, senior producer of OTM. Finally, for the first time ever, you can get an On the Media t-shirt, a notebook, a refrigerator magnet, a mouse pad, whatever. We got it. If you want it, you can find it by clicking the link on our website, onthemedia.org.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week in computer news, it's all about search. The Wall Street Journal noted that Google has come under the eye of government regulators. It's so popular, the journal said, that it's formed a natural, that is to say legal, monopoly. But that doesn't mean there aren't potential competitors. The tech media have been buzzing with anticipation because the world is about to get the chance to try a whole new way to find facts online.
Wolfram Alpha excels at finding answers to questions that have never been asked.
Nova Spivak is the CEO and founder of the search company Twine.com, not affiliated with Wolfram Alpha. He says the new web tool to be unveiled this weekend, named for its inventor Stephen Wolfram, isn't, strictly speaking, a search engine, it's an answer machine. Wolfram Alpha audaciously aims to amass all the formulas and data from all the world's sciences and systems, from physics to genetics to geography to the stock market. It will allow us to plot the paths of asteroids or compute crazy correlations between, say, the weather and the price of bread. Or, says Spivak, it can calculate answers to everyday questions.
Let's say that you want to know how many calories there are in a particular recipe. You could just type in the recipe. You know, let's say 2 tablespoons of marshmallow fluff, 2 tablespoons of peanut butter, 2 slices of whole wheat bread.
I think I know where you're going with this recipe.
How many calories are in that? It knows the number of calories in a tablespoon of peanut butter, in a tablespoon of marshmallow fluff, and in a slice of bread. And it knows the number of units of each, you know, 2 tablespoons, 2 pieces of bread. So then it can do a simple computation and then tell you, you know, this has, you know, I don't know, 1,500 calories or whatever it is.
Wolfram Alpha doesn't search for knowledge. It creates knowledge.
There's a huge, really, actually infinite amount of information that's not on the web, never will be on the web, and that you can get to much more efficiently by having a computation system that finds it.
Saul Hansel, editor of the New York Times' Bits blog, says that enterprising designers stay up nights pursuing the vanishing horizon of the perfect search.
Not only is search the Holy Grail, it was the Holy Grail that nobody thought they were looking for.
The internet boils over with information that can materially change your life, but finding it is like trying to drink from the proverbial fire hose. That's why search is the prime mover of cyberspace, the alpha and omega of the web. A dozen years ago, when web designers were immersed in jazzing up their homepages, Google's great leap forward was to harness the wisdom of crowds and list search results according to how often other people accessed pages with your search words. It worked so well, Google became the de facto front door to anything and everything online. Saul Hansel.
If you talk to any website, one of their big frustrations is nobody goes to their wonderful homepage. Everyone goes to Google and types in a query meant to get to the whatever it is deep inside their site that they want, and they go away. And the only relationship people have is with Google and the sense that Google can get them what they want.
I think if you're looking for this unconscious thing that happens with Google, it's more that it's your confidant or that it's been your best friend over time.
Danny Sullivan writes about search engines on his site, searchengineland.com.
You have continued to go over to it, tell it you're looking for things, and it says, oh, go to do this, or hey, I hear your pain, try that.
He says Google can be the secret sharer of questions you would never ask a real person, and that builds a strange kind of loyalty.
And so when you have a competitor comes along, it's very much like you have this new person who's saying, I want to be your best friend. You're going to be much more critical, right? Because you're already measuring them up against the first relationship you have. And if they don't measure up and they fail you, you're like, yeah, okay, I'm out of here.
Maybe the best friend metaphor isn't the fairest one. I think people are much, much more judgmental about their search engine than their best friend.
Tom Costello is the CEO and co-founder of last year's next big thing in search engines, Cool, spelled C-U-I-L, which means knowledge in Gaelic.
You don't turn to your best friend constantly and ask them questions and judge them on the results. And that's what people do to search engines. And that's why in a search engine business, traffic growth comes slowly and steadily because you have to win over users one search at a time, and every time they come, they're judging, do we get the right answer or not?
Unlike Wolfram Alpha, Cool delivers an array of pages in response to a few keywords, like Google, but with some crucial differences. Cool indexes and crawls far more pages than Google does, and it doesn't collect data on your searches, so it's far more private. Most important, it doesn't rely so much on the popularity of pages. Instead, it checks websites for words that are related to your search words. The result, says Costello, is fewer irrelevant pages.
If a page mentions, for instance, hip surgery, we would look rather than how often is hip surgery mentioned, we would look at the other terms that are mentioned so we know whether or not the page is actually about the right content. That's the different idea in our ranking as opposed to just looking at popularity.
So in other words, if you're looking up hip surgery, a page from a novel that might mention hip surgery isn't going to come up on top of that search.
Exactly, because we're going to be looking for other terms that we think are important, like, for instance, arthritis or a broken hip, the other terms that people care about.
After much hoopla, Cool launched last summer to lukewarm reviews. It has since made many improvements, but the world has moved on to the next big thing. New York Times' Bits blogger, Saul Hansel.
What happened to Cool is probably what will happen to Wolfram Alpha. They oversold themselves. They didn't come to the world and say, we're working on things that a couple years from now might get to be really interesting. They said, we've got something that's better than Google. That's a pretty tall order.
But the creator of Wolfram Alpha doesn't claim it's the next Google. He says it's a supplement to Google. Nova Spivak merely observes that
Wolfram Alpha is essentially the greatest calculator ever built.
There's a fictional precedent for that. The device dubbed Deep Thought chronicled in The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Oh, Deep Thought. We want you to tell us the answer.
The answer to what?
the answer to life, the universe, everything. We'd really like an answer. Something simple.
Saul Hansel and I tested Wolfram Alpha on an easier question.
So we are now at Wolfram Alpha Computational Knowledge Engine.
So can you ask, what is the difference between a poodle and a collie?
Input interpretation, Poodle, United Kingdom, and collie, Western Australia. And it is telling us that Poodle has 150,000 people and collie has 6,336 people. And it is telling us, in case we wanted to know, that the distance between them is 9,146 miles.
So basically what you're saying is that it couldn't read the difference between poodle and collie because there isn't a statistical answer to that question.
I think that's right, or it doesn't happen to know anything about poodles and collies.
It does not happen to know about breeds. It knows about species, but it doesn't know about breeds.
Stephen Wolfram, who invented Wolfram Alpha, says it's still loading knowledge and it tried to answer a question it read as misspelled, but it will know all about breeds in a month or so.
Maybe sooner. Breeds of dogs has been one that's definitely on the pipeline. I'll give it an extra push. How about that?
You know what? The truth is I really don't care. I was just wondering when one could get a grip on information that is calculatable but not instantly translatable into numbers. You can't plug a poodle into a program.
Right, but the concept of a thing like a city or a poodle or a type of metal or something, these are all things that have properties that Wolfram Alpha can deal with. Well, you might say, you know, you can't plug a country into a program, but you can certainly plug many properties of a country into a program. For example, the evolution of its GDP over time or the geometry of its borders. Those are all things that are readily computable.
Wolfram, who also invented the computer algebra system Mathematica, says the effort to encapsulate the world's knowledge in a computable form dates back at least 300 years to the great mathematician Gottfried Leibniz.
He had the idea of even building mechanical calculators and trying to get the leaders of his time to assemble giant libraries to feed knowledge into the sort of mechanized system, which I think is very much along the same lines as what we've tried to do with Wolfram Alpha. The problem is that Gottfried Leibniz was 300 years too early. It wasn't realistic to build what's needed using clockwork machines and books written in manuscript form and so on.
Leibniz would have understood Wolfram Alpha. But what would he have made of Twitter's search engine, which plumbs the here and now, the global zeitgeist, or Google, which delivers pages in the order of their popularity? Popularity is part of what makes Google popular. Also, its ubiquity and its adaptability. Search mavens say Google may never be overtaken, that it's more likely to buy and assimilate the innovations of others. But while some allow that our passion for Google may not burn indefinitely, our passion for search certainly will. Because search is addictive. Because one question begets another, and we're never satisfied with the answer.
The answer to the ultimate question of life, the universe, and everything is... Forty-two.
Yes, I thought it over quite thoroughly. It is, it's 42.
Check out our extended interview with compulsive searcher Danny Sullivan of searchengineland.com at onthemedia.org.
This week, Craigslist announced it would discontinue the erotic services section of its site. After several big media stories about Craigslist killers this spring and mounting pressure from states' attorneys general, Craigslist decided it would change the name of the section to Adult Services and have a Craigslist employee screen every $10 ad bought in that section for content that might violate its terms of service or the law. Previously, the site had mainly relied on users to do that job. The state attorneys general, for their part, don't have much of the law on their side when it comes to dealing with Craigslist. Under the Communications Decency Act of 1996, websites are not legally responsible for material contributed by users. Not to mention a little thing called the First Amendment that offers prior restraint protection even to all those foot masseuses out there. Illinois Attorney General Lisa Madigan was one of those pressuring Craigslist to do something because of what she saw happening in her state.
We here in Illinois, in the Attorney General's office, we hold a federal grant for the Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force, and we just see horrifying situations, tragedies that occur. And one of the significant problems with Craigslist erotic services section is that there are far too many ads where, you know, in addition to it being illegal because it's prostitution, it's really trafficking that's going on and the exploitation of children taking place.
I'm glad you said that, because I want it to be clear that you're not just being a morality scold here. But that said, what law has Craigslist broken?
They have a responsibility. The ads that were being put up on their erotic services section, we don't even have to get to what's illegal. They didn't even meet Craigslist's own terms of use on their site. And so we encourage them initially to simply police their own site, enforce their own terms of use. There are people who would argue that, you know, they're protected by the law. You know, they don't control what people post. But society's not going to put up with a situation where nobody has any responsibility when you're providing a form for this to take place. You can't just stick your head in the sand and act as if it's not happening.
I don't think there's anybody on the media who is in favor of a lively market for prostitution, certainly not for the exploitation of women and children. But I am concerned about the government strong-arming a website on matters of content. It seems to me that we're getting into a First Amendment area that's a little alarming.
Well, you know, you're trying to kind of make the slippery slope argument. Listen, I think Craigslist is an extraordinary website. I'm not sitting here saying, hey, Craigslist, you shouldn't be putting up ads for jobs. No, we're saying you've got to recognize that your site has become the number one internet brothel, and you have to take some responsibility for this.
Attorney General Madigan, thank you.
Bob, it's my pleasure.
Lisa Madigan is the Attorney General of Illinois. Jim Buckmaster is CEO of Craigslist, and he joins us. Jim, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
As you know, we just got off the phone with Lisa Madigan, the Attorney General of Illinois. And, you know, I don't believe I'm mischaracterizing her statement in saying that she all but conceded that she had no law with which to prosecute you, but was able, with her colleagues, other attorneys general, essentially to coercing you into changing your practices. Do you feel as if you've been strong-armed in any way?
If you consult virtually any legal expert that knows about internet law, not to mention laws pertaining to free speech, clearly Craigslist at all times has been operating in compliance with all applicable laws so that we bear no legal liability. But to us, that was kind of beside the point. What we're trying to do is consider all feedback that we get from concerned parties and see what we can do to adopt measures that are going to improve the site. They say, you know, you struck the right balance when everyone's unhappy. Some attorneys general are still critical. A lot of legal businesses think our new standards are too stringent. Folks from the free speech community are, I've saw one refer to me as a cheese-eating surrender monkey.
Well, I guess if you are, in fact, a cheese-eating surrender monkey, you surrendered in the interest of protecting innocent victims. And that gets to what I think is the central issue of all of this. Is there anything about Craigslist or the internet that should be making us rethink the First Amendment, for example?
Well, I think the first thing that's important to do is put things in perspective and make sure we're not overreacting. And I always hesitate to use an analogy, but I'll try one here. Imagine if we brought the same standard to automobiles that some think we should bring to the internet, namely, if it's possible for someone to get hurt in connection with this tool, then we need to write a bunch of new regulations. Well, let's look at the automobile. why is it okay that an average automobile can go twice the maximum speed limit on any highway? Why is it okay that you're not forced to wear a seatbelt in an automobile? This is a tool that people use, and 45,000 people are killed each year, and not to mention the number of people maimed and, you know, put in a wheelchair for the rest of their life. I would argue that the internet is so safe compared to an automobile that you can't even talk about them in the same sentence, and yet we're seeing kind of a mass hysteria. Okay, we feel terrible that Craigslist was used in connection with a murder. That's a terrible tragedy. Just like it's a terrible tragedy when someone is killed in an automobile accident. But when you're talking about an attorney general saying that the operators of a site like ours, where we're bending over backwards, trying to do the right thing, suggesting that we're criminals, I mean, come on.
Sometimes it's hard to keep two apparently opposing thoughts in your head at the same time, but it strikes me that you're both trying to do the right thing and also feeling scapegoated. Am I right about that?
I think there's some truth there. There has been a bit of a witch hunt or a use of Craigslist as a political pinata, since if you look at the underlying statistics, Craigslist is clearly far safer than print classifieds have ever been. And we're going to great lengths to try to put the measures in place that will ultimately create the safest site possible. We feel like a disservice has been done to some extent to readers and viewers of media that have tried to portray Craigslist as somehow uniquely dangerous, when in fact, if you look at the statistics, exactly the opposite is true.
Well, Jim, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Jim Buckmaster is the CEO of Craigslist.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Wallace Foundation, where arts and education leaders can learn about how to bring the arts to more people. Downloads at the Knowledge Center at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
What is your name?
My name is James Tiberius Kirk.
The global box office for the newest Star Trek film grossed about $111 million in its first weekend. Not bad at all. The total world box office for all 11 Star Trek films over the past 30 years is estimated at more than $1 billion. The franchise is nothing if not durable, and so are the jokes about it. The best one we saw was from The Onion.
I'm just really, really disappointed that this storyline made sense.
If I wanted to see young, attractive people doing cool, exciting things, I'd go watch sports.
And with us now to discuss the backlash is entertainment reporter Bree Lindsey.
Hi, Glenn.
Bree, is this Star Trek as riveting as the fans are complaining it is?
Oh, Glenn, early reviewers are calling it a delight.
In this era of online communities and instant media feedback, we sometimes forget that Star Trek was an entertainment franchise effectively shaped, elevated, and frequently resuscitated by its fans. To mark the 40th anniversary of Star Trek back in September 2006, we managed, through great effort, to secure a committed Trekkie to explain what's kept the franchise afloat. In honor of the film, here's a replay. I'm sorry, did I say Trekkie? I mean, of course, Trekker.
Okay, I can hear that tone in your voice. I'm used to it, because I admit it, I am and have ever been a Star Trek fan.
Get a life,
will you, people?
For crying out loud, it's just a TV show.
When William Shatner said that on Saturday Night Live, though to be fair, he didn't write it, it stung.
I think a lot of fans feel like they are not respected. They're almost ashamed to admit they're fans of Star Trek unless they hear two or three references to Star Trek in the conversation.
Not Barbara Adams. So moved was she by the series' optimistic, pluralistic vision of the future that when serving on the jury in the Whitewater trial 10 years ago, she wore the uniform of a Starfleet officer. If it helps to make people think a little more about what those ideals are, then I'll keep wearing this uniform, she said, and then was promptly dismissed for talking to the press. Those ideals were codified by Gene Roddenberry, a former flack with the LAPD, who cut his teeth writing Dragnet scripts on spec for Jack Webb. His enterprise was staffed by a crack multiracial crew, and though that crew was prohibited by the prime directive from interfering in developing societies, as they hopped from planet to planet, Captain James T. Kirk found some way to stamp out race hatred, fascism, and religious extremism wherever he went. As Tim Cavanaugh observes in the current issue of Reason magazine, the world of Star Trek was not so much a utopia as a kind of galactic great society, which he says eerily predicted the era of total interventionism.
Star Trek prefigures neoconservatism because it's socially liberal. But anytime there's a whiff of totalitarianism or just something that Kirk doesn't like about a planet, he'll find a way to overthrow the government. And they'll leave at the end of the episode. It's like, okay, well, we got rid of, you know, the god that these people have been worshiping for 5,000 generations or something, and now they're on their own. You'll enjoy freedom.
Roddenberry allowed us to examine the convulsions of the 60s, like the Cold War, poverty, and hippies, at a distance, mostly through aliens, since he had decreed that there would be no serious conflicts among the crew. But occasionally controversy did creep onto the bridge, as when Kirk and his black female communications officer, Lieutenant Uhura, played by Nichelle Nichols, engaged in America's first interracial TV smooch. Despite network fears, it didn't spark much rage, perhaps because
there are mind-controlling aliens who make them do it, and, you know, they're sort of fighting it all the way, which, of course, just makes it even hotter.
I'm so frightened, Captain. I'm so very frightened. I wish I could stop trembling.
Try not to think of them. Try.
Part of the Star Trek lore is that Nichelle Nichols, and this is a first-person claim by her, that she wanted to quit the show at some point in its run, and Martin Luther King personally appealed to her to keep doing the show because she was the only black woman on TV who wasn't playing a maid, and that's below the Voting Rights Act or Brown versus Board of Education or something in terms of achievement, but it was actually big stuff then. I mean, it was seemed controversial at the time.
And I would hear your voice from all parts of the ship.
But controversy didn't kill the show. After three seasons, the ratings did. And for almost two decades, as the ranks of fans swelled through reruns and conventions, they wrote their own episodes and lobbied the network. Henry Jenkins, MIT professor, says that much of that pressure came from an unexpected quarter.
I think if you go back and look at the original letter-writing campaign that kept the series on the air for that third season, which made it viable for a syndication package, the majority of the leaders of that campaign were women. And while the women were disappointed in the ways they were portrayed on Star Trek often, it kept alive this idea that women alongside men would be active participants in shaping the future.
So finally, after a short-lived animated show and a handful of movies, a new live-action series was launched. And instead of boldly going where no man had gone before, the new crew was to
boldly go where no one has gone before.
We had three female cast members on Next Generation.
Executive producer Rick Berman.
One was Counselor Troy, one was the Doctor, and there was some discussion that here we had two women in caretaker roles, which seemed a little sexist. But Jean also created this character, Tasha Yar, who was the head of security on board the ship. And she was a tough broad and probably the sexiest of the three.
Berman was handpicked by Roddenberry to launch the second series, but he's been widely reviled by the fans for coming to the franchise as a newbie and for failing to fully commit to the founder's vision.
If I could sit and corral all the things that have been said over the years, especially on the internet, you could put me just a little bit this side of Himmler. Did I see the original series as sacrosanct and sacred? No. Did I do my very best to keep from contradicting anything that occurred in those episodes? Absolutely.
Star Trek The Next Generation also depicted a crew on a voyage of exploration, this time captained by the resolutely rational Jean-Luc Picard, a contrast to the impulsive Kirk. It lasted 7 years, bookended by episodes in which an omnipotent being called Q put humanity on trial.
You will now answer to the charge of being a grievously savage race.
Grievously savage could mean anything.
I will answer only specific charges.
Are you certain you want a full disclosure of human ugliness? So be it, fool. Present the charges!
It's a squeaker, but guess who wins? In Star Trek, humanity always wins. The sole exception was series number 3, Deep Space Nine, mounted by Berman after Roddenberry's death. Set on a space station in a time of war, humans and aliens were forced to confront crime and corruption within the crew, and the humanity within all these species did not always win.
Will that be all, Commander?
I want you to know, I don't personally believe that you're responsible for this.
Really? Now, how can that be true? You don't know me. So don't tell me there isn't some doubt inside of you, some question about whether or not I murdered the man.
Some die-hard fans grumbled about the dark nature of Deep Space Nine, very un-Roddenberry, but that series also lasted 7 years. The fourth series, Star Trek Voyager, was set on a ship flung to the outer reaches of the galaxy. Its mission was simply to return home, and it also marked a return to the original vision. Only this time, the glass ceiling was broken. Rick Berman.
We wrestled a great deal with trying to find an actress who could play the captain on Voyager who at the same time could be feminine and tough.
We don't run.
Don't be foolish. Leave now and save yourselves.
Give me my people and we'll do just that.
They're mine.
And get ready for a fight. Red alert.
Did you have to grapple with the idea of femininity, or did you just leave that whole discussion off the table?
No, of course I had to grapple with it, and it was one of the hardest things, and it was in extreme evidence from the first moment.
Kate Mulgrew played Captain Catherine Janeway.
And I realized that what was at stake was their largest and most robust demographic, young men from the ages of 20 to 35. How was I going to transcend the fact that they could be potentially watching their mother?
In fact, they watched her for 7 years, even though the bodacious Borg 7 of 9 was added to the crew to boost ratings. But even she represented more than just sex appeal, because in Star Trek, humanity was always the real final frontier, so the best-loved characters were not human. The half-Vulcan Spock in the first series, the android Data in the second, Odo, the shapeshifter, in the third, and 7 of 9 in the fourth. They showed what it meant to be human by reacting against it, or more often, groping toward it. Here's Data on a date.
This is all part of a program?
Yes, one which I have just created for romantic relationships. I have written a subroutine specifically for you. I have devoted a considerable share of my internal resources to its development.
Data... that's the nicest thing anybody's ever said to me.
Later, Data gets an emotion chip, but ultimately rejects it. Spock would approve. He never understood Kirk's infatuation with humanity.
But, Captain, we both know that I am not human.
Spock, you want to know something? Everybody's human.
I find that remark insulting.
I love Spock. He's really awesome.
What's your name?
Emma.
How old are you?
15.
We found Emma at the Mohegan Sun Casino in Northern Connecticut checking out a display of Star Trek memorabilia soon to be auctioned by Christie's. Like thousands of others, Emma writes fan fiction, original stories based on the series, and she posts them on her blog, as do many of her friends.
Most of them write from the original series, Kirk and Spock. They either write slash or just friendship.
Through the fans, Star Trek lives long and prospers in cyberspace, where they create and consume thousands of news stories and hundreds of videos, including new episodes. It's not what Trekkers solemnly regard as Star Trek canon. It's called fanon, a tapestry of new plots and backstories endlessly embroidered by fans. And for decades, they have boldly taken Star Trek where no network ever would, including, as Emma just said, slash fiction, as in Kirk slash Spock, as in the love that dare not speak its name. MIT prof Henry Jenkins.
All of fan fiction is interested in exploring the emotional lives of characters.
Consider Spock's death scene in The Wrath of Khan, behind a wall of glass.
Kirk is on one side of the glass, Spock is on the other, and Spock comes closest to speaking the emotional truth of their relationship.
The needs of the many outweigh
the needs of the few.
or the one. I have been, and always shall be, your friend. Live long and prosper.
If we accept that the Kirk and Spock were the most powerful friendship in the series, and that Spock or Kurt would sacrifice any female lover to save the other, then we understand what's at stake. That what Slash does, or Kirk Spock stories do, is remove that glass. Sex becomes the vehicle for exploring emotional intimacy between these two characters. So it's an enormously innovative and rich sight of grassroots media.
I asked Kate Mulgrew what she thought of the Trekkers she'd met.
Whereas I may have looked once upon these people with a jaundiced eye, as the years passed, I began to understand that this was a very uncommon group of extremely intelligent people who had thrown their imaginations into the final frontier. So I find them very forward-thinking, very innovative, and by and large, extremely moral.
We grew up really loving Star Trek in the purest possible way.
Reason Magazine's Tim Cavanaugh.
We just loved it as kids. You get to high school, you get to college, suddenly you become this super ironist, and you realize how campy it is and over the top. And every joke about Captain Kirk getting it on with green women, or about crew members wearing red shirts and dying, or what Mr. Spock found in the toilet, they've all been made. To some degree, the show has outlived all of that stuff.
Which may be irrelevant to fans for whom the show may have actually outlived the show.
I don't think fans should worry about there not being a Star Trek series on. If it's not a good Star Trek series, if it's not showing us what we want to see in Star Trek, we don't have to have it there.
For instance, the most recent series called Enterprise was not embraced by erstwhile Whitewater juror Barbara Adams, and she's communications officer for her fan club called the Federation Alliance, which requires most of its members to do community service to make this world now a better place.
I think that we should work at that future that Gene showed us 40 years ago. The ideals can still survive within our minds and certainly within our communities as long as we work at it.
At some point, for fans like Adams, Star Trek shape-shifted from a franchise to a kind of creed, perhaps because Roddenberry made it seem almost plausible, because it made use of real science and referenced real history. Or maybe it's because his founding vision was bound up in the belief that ultimately it is our shortcomings, our passion, our restlessness that will save us. That as much as Vulcan logic and detachment are venerated in the Trek world, it's somehow better to be human.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, Nasanin Rafsanjani, Michael Bernstein, and PJ Vogt, with more help from Cara Gianfrido and Ethan Cheel, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Zach Marsh. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Catcher Rogers is our senior producer, and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts at onthemedia.org. You can also post comments there or email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. But before we go, it's time to mark a great loss to On the Media and a great victory for the excellent Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. It has stolen away Megan Ryan to be its senior producer. And that hurts. She managed us when our senior producer was on maternity leave. She drove us hard and mopped our sweaty brows. She never allowed us to fall back on habit or groupthink.
But probably it's her sense of adventure and her sense of humor that we'll miss most. Megan shows up in most of our joke pieces. Here she is in our mashup of the Bill O'Reilly-Keith Olbermann rivalry.
I think the real war began when Keith started calling him Ted Baxter. And then he included O'Reilly in the worst person segment 16 times. 16 times! I told him, Keith, you're declaring war. And he just laughed. I tried to warn him.
Here she is as the head of a fictional think tank, commenting after a real radical Islamic website put up a real post suggesting that John McCain would be better for global jihad.
Well, Bob, first, it's not an endorsement per se. It's more like political analysis, a statement of what would most benefit global Muslim hegemony. But beyond that, it's been said this is the most important presidential election of our lifetimes. If that's true for Democrats and Republicans, it's no less true for Islamofascists. Remember, a terror cell, before it conducts its operations, is a small business, and Obama's tax policies are a big worry.
When the media noted that then-Pakistan President Pervez Musharraf had shed his army uniform for a business suit, she suggested we do Project Runway Dictator Edition.
If one of you would have to go home, who should it be and why?
It was his idea to do a woman's outfit for Gaddafi, kind of sexpot despot, but I feel like all that fabric was bulky and cheap, so I think he should go. Sorry.
No, that's
no, Megan, we're sorry. We're really sorry.
We do not have the words to express the role you've played here at OTM these 7 years, so maybe we should leave that to Michael Kors.
It was impeccable, you know, gave the character, I think, a sense of power, but at the same time, it was very feminine.
Megan, we'll miss you.
I hope you'll keep talking to us over the wall. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.